So it starts with connection. It moves to communication, leading by listening, seeking to understand their points of view. And now that we have common and shared understanding, then we can move together and co-create and collaborate so that we can create the positive outcome and create the vision for the future and turning that vision into reality.
Oh, such a good question.
Well, when you come with these questions, that's another great branding question.
That's a big question.
That's a very interesting question because it really makes you think about what you just did.
Welcome to the Your Living Brand Live Show. This show is all about how you communicate your value, how you build influence through trust, and recognizing who your audience is and who they are not. Through our weekly conversations with our guests, we will explore different ways to enable you to demonstrate your uniqueness while we ask them, what's your story? And now, welcome our host, Ben Baker.
And welcome back to another episode of the Your Living Brand Live Show. Thank you all once again every week for coming back, for listening to the show, for sharing it, for subscribing it, for being such amazing audience. I love the things that you guys do. Send me emails at ben@yourbrandmarketing.com. Tell me what you liked about the show, what you like to hear in terms of guests. I love hearing your comments. This week, I've got Alain Erkins on, and we're going to talk about the future of leadership. Now, Alain is the author of Cracking the Leadership Code, and he and I have had such an amazing conversation off air. I'm just going to bring him on, and we're going to have this conversation because we really need to talk about the future of leadership. Alain, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Ben. Yes, we really need to talk. Ben, we really need to talk here.
Can we talk? Can we do coffee talk?
We can talk. If you want to talk, we'll talk, yeah, Ben.
That's right. We'll do the New York thing. We'll do the coffee talk thing.
Yeah, that's where I grew up. I grew up in Queens, so it's not so hard for me.
Oh, there you go. So you're very welcome to that accent.
Yeah. There we go. Exactly.
Yeah. Now, I mean, you and I met through some mutual friends, and they said you have to talk to them. You got to talk about leadership. And I've read some stuff that you've done, and we've gone back and forth on a couple of posts, and I love your vision of leadership. And I think that leadership is going to become more and more imperative as we move past COVID, as we move into the new next, whatever we want to call it. And I think that it's really important. But before we get there, before we get into the conversation, give people a little bit of a history about where you are, where you came from, and what brought you into leadership space.
Sure. Yeah. So for me, let me just start by level setting some things around leadership, because that word means different things to different people. And my working definition around leadership is any time that anybody is trying to get anybody, that could be you, could be anybody else, anytime that anybody is trying to get anybody to do anything, that takes leadership. Right. So you cast it that way, it is a very broad tent. And the fact is, so we're all leading every day. And I got interested in leadership because I've always been really fascinated by people, specifically why people do what they do and how one person sets the environment or sets the tone for the people in their particular organization. And if I look at why did I get so interested in this ever since I can possibly remember, has a lot to do with my upbringing. So I mentioned I grew up in Flushing, Queens. So that's why I talk like this sometimes if I want to. It's legit. When I see my old friends, that's where I go to. And so I grew up in Queens, not unusual. Was raised by a single mom, my grandmother, not unusual. The unusual part, fairly unusual part, is that my mother and my grandmother are both Holocaust survivors. So my mother's born in 1935 in Belgium, of the child of Polish Jews. So Nazis invade Belgium, 1942, end of 41, 42. My mother is separated from her mother. She's put in hiding for 3.5 years till the end of the war, is moved from a convent to a foster family. She has her hair dyed blonde. She's given a false name. And miraculously, both her and her mother survived, whereas the rest of the family perished. They get together, they survive, but you can imagine the kind of worldview that creates for you later on. So then my mother comes to the US, she has my brother, then me, and then my grandmother comes over, my parents divorce. I'm raised by these two Holocaust survivors. And the weirdest thing growing up, and of course I didn't have any words for this at the time, was just the experience, the vibe. You think about what we know about leadership is leaders create a vibe. And the vibe in my house was so different than the vibe at my friends' houses or the vibe when I see my dad on the weekends or the vibe at school. And I guess I was, for me, this subject of leadership was trying to figure out what the heck is inside of this. That vibe, it's a very squiggly, slippery word. Like, what is that vibe and how do you create that vibe? And why does it seem that some people do better in certain vibes than other things? So that led to studying psychology. It led me to studying theater. I actually trained as a professional actor. And then I got involved in psychodrama and group process facilitation work, which led me to leadership and management training in schools and then into organizations and working in corporations. So that's kind of the journey that got me into this, of which then I started noticing the more people and the more groups I work with. Maybe you've heard this expression, Ben, that there are only 7 plots to a novel. Like, you see the same things recycled, and I'd see the same patterns of behavior show up time and time again. But the story would be slightly different because every story is unique. So I started taking notes, and the notes turned into blog posts, and the blog posts turned into chapters. And that's what this book, Cracking the Leadership Code, is really a distillation of 25 years, or in some ways 50 years, of reflecting back on human behavior and what does it take to be an effective leader, to create the vibe where people can thrive and do great work and feel great about it.
And I love that. I mean, you and I don't know this part of us, but, you know, I come from a Jewish, you know, background. We've been Jews for, you know, 2,000 years or 5,000 years. I was lucky enough that my family came over in 1919.
Yeah.
You know, so what my story was is that my grandfather survived the Tsar's army and came over by himself. And, you know, Bakarovich became Baker because he didn't speak, you know, English. And yeah. The Irishman at Ellis Island didn't speak Polish. So we became... Yeah. Bakarovich became Baker, you know, that whole ability to have powerful people in our lives, you know, the people that really helped us codify who we are, you know, what we're about, you know, where we came from, where we are, where we're going is extremely powerful. And I love what you said before, because the expression I use is leadership is a mindset and not a job title. And I want to crack into all of that. I mean, let's crack into all of it because it's so important. That what were the things when you were doing the leadership code and you were talking about leadership, what were the essences that you were coming up with that you were sitting there going, okay, these are the things that are working and these are the things that are not?
Yeah. So you touched on it already here, Ben. It's a sense of, first of all, you talk about leadership is this state of mind. It's a state of being, and it really comes down to our beliefs and our mindset and what are the stories that we tell ourselves. So for example, what's the story that you tell yourself when you say, I am a leader? How do you feel and how do you think as things go? You know, and so for me, you know, a funny thing happened. So I've got 2 kids who are now 16 and 13. My son Alex is 16. My daughter Miranda is 13. But this happened about 10 years ago. So they're 6 and 3. And the two of them they're goofing off in the living room, as little kids are want to do, right? And I got to confess, Ben, I got a bit triggered. I was in the other room and I came into the room. And I kid you not, what came out of my mouth was this. I said, would you two stop behaving like children? Now, I'm telling you this for 2 reasons. Number one, that is a completely ridiculous thing to say to a 6 and a 3-year-old, clearly. But number two, as soon as those words came out of my mouth, I was in complete shock, Ben, because that phrase, would you stop behaving like children, in the way I said it, was the exact same phrase that my mother used to use with my brother and I when we were kids, right? So unconsciously, I'd copied the behavior of the previous generation, which leads me to think, why do we lead the way we do? Well, unless you really think about it, you are going to copy the behavior of the previous generation, and they copy their leaders and so on and so forth. But if you take that logic train to its destination, you're going to end up somewhere. Who started the whole thing? And this is where I dug into the research, and I found a New Yorker article, which led me to reading more about a guy, you might know him, Frederick Winslow Taylor, who is considered the father of the field of management. Because you think about it, we didn't have big businesses. We didn't, before the industrial age, things were home-based economy, farm-based economy. So suddenly you have these factories and you need all these employees who need to be led and managed, and you have production and big capital equipment, and was obviously hugely labor intensive. So they get this guy, Frederick Winslow Taylor, who, by the way, is a mechanical engineer by training. So that's just the way he thinks. He thinks that the world is engineering. And so he sees the factory as this machine, basically. And so in this machine, you're going to throw in some parts. Oh, we've got humans. We're not going to call them human beings. They're now human resources, right? And you think about it, they plug in these interchangeable parts into the machine. And that was the way he described it. And in fact, his book, which was written in 1911, called Principles of Scientific Management, he describes the ideal workman. And I say man, because at the time that's what it was. And I quote this one because I could not make this up if I tried. He described the ideal workman as someone who is, quote, so stupid and phlegmatic that he more nearly resembled in his mental makeup the ox than any other type, end quote. Right. So the idea is you're chattel, you know, you are just labor. And the goal was for you to be the brawn, and leadership or management, they were the brains, they do the thinking. Or as Henry Ford put it so poetically about his employees, why is it every time I want a pair of hands, they come with a brain attached, right? So the whole value proposition of leadership, followership at the time was leaders command and control and workers conform and comply. Don't think for yourself. And you know what? They got by with that for decades, right? Through the industrial age, really up until, we'll say, even the 1960s, the 1970s. And then things started to shift. We moved from the industrial age into the information age. And then actually, you actually need people with brains. You need people to think. And as we move from the information age into now the digital age, the fact is all of that manual labor has been automated or outsourced or algorithmized and is being done somewhere. So what is left now is the human factor. So you have people all the way down. It's been pushed to the front lines where people have to think and clarify problems and solve customer needs and be able to harness technology and use it in real time. So if your belief is my job as a leader is to be the smart person in the room and tell everybody what to do, you are living in the 20th century and you are destined to struggle in this 21st century world that we live in.
And that's, you know, both enlightening and terrifying at the same time.
Totally.
It truly is, because you're right. We are taught by the generations before us. And we build our habits based on the generations before us. And we learn how to lead based on the people that came before us. And if that's truly how we've been taught to lead, by command and control, by carrot and stick, those antiquated methods no longer apply. And we are no longer the cogs in the wheel, you know, in the Henry Ford, you know, factory, that your job was to sit there and tighten that wrench 8 hours, 10 hours a day, 5 days a week. You know, that same need for people to just be those pliable parts within the system no longer exists. Even within the Ford plants today, you know, they're far more sophisticated. It's far more, you know, needs for the average worker to be far more aware of their surroundings and far more thought provoking. But you used a word that to me is the crux of the whole thing, and that's manager. And I look at the word manager as part of that antiquated system. And I'm going to use a phrase about managing process and leading people. And I want your thoughts on that and how we move that mind shift to be able to get leaders at all levels to be able to understand that differentiation and be able to lead accordingly.
Such a valuable distinction, Ben. Yes, the sense of managers and leaders. Because if you think about it, yeah, you do manage process. And this comes out of that mechanistic thinking. Now, look, there's a place for process. We're not saying that you have people come to work and just be so creative that they do whatever they want. I mean, you have a job, you have a customer base, you have a mission and a purpose. You want to do all that. Yet the management mindset tends to be very mechanistic, very linear, sequential, very binary. There's a right way. There's a wrong way. This is good. This is bad. This is black. This is white. You know, and that works with certain things around process. But a big part of the world that we live in is, how do we learn how to embrace ambiguity and realize maybe there's not one right way to do this. Maybe there's 18 right ways to do this. And my job as the leader is to create an environment where for this particular person who I'm leading, that they bring their own unique set of skills and gifts and strengths to this job. And they are able to do it that one out of the best 18 ways that works for them. Because let's face it, the way you would talk to someone to make them feel valued is going to feel different than the way I would. You know, let's give you a funny example on this. So everyone's familiar with the Walt Disney World, the Disney organization, and they're kind of known for their customer service. And they also have a certain Disney way of doing things. So for example, they talk about the fact that everyone is a guest, you know, and that everyone is there backstage and front stage. So I was staying at a Disney property years ago to lead a training. And I remember calling down to the front desk because my iron wasn't working. I needed something like that. So I called down to the front desk and the person picked up the phone and this is what they said. And obviously they thought it was an outside call, but basically they were reading off the script and this is what it sounded like. "It's a wonderful day at the Magic Kingdom. How can I help you?" You know, that's what they said. So clearly they were given the script, like this is the right thing to say, but they brought none of the internal cell. Clearly that's the definition.
They were phoning it in. They were literally phoning it in.
That is the definition of phoning it in. That's it, right? That's, you don't get any more phoning it in than on the phone like that. And so, you know, how do we create environments where people can thrive? And this distinction between manager and leader is so, so important.
Well, let's get into that because a lot of it comes down to, in my mind, empowerment. You have a top-down leader, and we have, you know, a wide variety of different types of leader. But let's take a look at the leader of, you know, the average small to medium-sized business. Mm-hmm. Most of them never thought they were ever going to be leaders of people. They never even dreamed they were going to be leaders of people. They came up, they had an idea, they created a small business, that business grew, and all of a sudden they went from 1 to 3 to 5, 10 to 20 to 50 to maybe 100 employees, but they never had any training of how to run a company as that company grew, you know, and that goes for leadership across numerous types of organizations. So how do we instill that mindset of, you know, we need to sit there and go from that command and control that most small business leaders have because they don't know any other way, to somewhere where we're dealing with empowerment, where I sit there at the top. I'm the one who's the visionary. I'm the one who builds purpose and culture and, you know, helps my people succeed and trusts my people to do what needs to be done to be able to make the company better, realizing that they're probably smarter than I am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you bring up some really important points here. First of all, yeah, this can be in the small business person who started off and they grew the company to 100 or so. It can also be in the large organization where you have the, let's say, the sales person who's a really good salesperson who's like, "You're really good, Ben. We're going to promote you and make you the sales manager," right? So you're now leading the sales team. In both cases, here's the commonality, is you have someone who started there and they actually excelled at being a high performer. And because of that, a new opportunity arose, whether it's a small business growing, whether you got promoted. But here's the rub, which is there is a monumental gap between being a high performer and facilitating high performance in other people. And you do not close that gap by just doing more of what you did, just by working harder. So you have to fundamentally rethink, how do I go about working? And you can even, like you were saying, Ben, like, okay, I have this vision, but I have to empower my people and I have to trust them to do this. Like if I said to you, Ben, okay, you're a small business owner of 100 people, go and empower your people, go and make them trustworthy. Frankly, you'd come back and say, what the heck do I do? Because you don't do empowerment. You don't do trust. Empowerment and trust come as a result of other things that you do. Yes, I just said doo-doo on the air. Yes. This is the thing.
You do that voodoo that you do so well.
Yes. As you do. Yes. So here's the thing, is to realize, so what is it that you do actually do if you're a leader? And this is where I break it down to the what I call the three overarching skill sets, or the subtitle of the book, The Three Secrets to Building Strong Leaders, which are, it's around connection, communication, and collaboration. So for example, if I want to build trust, trust comes a result of building a strong connection with people. Now, how do I, now that let's drill it down further. How do I build strong connection? Well, first, I start by demonstrating empathy. Empathy is defined as showing people that you understand them and care how they feel. You probably remember, I forget who said it, but people won't care how much you know until they know how much you care. So basically, do you see me as your follower? Do you see me, value me as a human being first and foremost? And I think everyone listening to that is hearing this going, duh, blinding flash of the obvious. Yes, it's true. It is common sense. However, it's not common practice. And the reason why, there's a bunch of reasons, but a couple of the big reasons, showing people that you understand them and care how they feel, aka empathy, is not something you can just put on your to-do list and check off like everything else, like take the garbage out, you know? So showing empathy actually takes showing patience because, yeah, your digital workplace might be operating at internet speeds, but human relationships move much more slowly than your bandwidth. So you have to know there's a time and a place to go slow and there's a time and a place to go fast. And you have to have the wisdom to know the difference between those things. So that's one huge reason. Another big reason is the fact is you are dealing with human beings. I don't care if you're in the pharmaceutical business or you're in the communications business, you're in the people business. This is what you are in. And if you're leading, your primary thing is people. And it's not, you know, here's so many leaders, you know, they get so focused on the results and realizing like your results, whether you want to measure it as profit, revenue, sales, customer satisfaction, those are all lagging indicators of something that happened because someone did something, right? That's only the result of your people. And so if you're so focused on the numbers, realize you may want to reprioritize the way you think, because if you start focusing on the people and prioritize the people, it's your people that deliver the numbers. So why wouldn't you focus on that first? And if you look at almost every single business meeting around North America, what do we talk about first? Okay, let's look at last month's numbers. Let's look at the numbers. Let's look at this. What's going on? And then if there's time left over, well, what are the people stuff, right? We go numbers, then we go to projects, and then we get to people. You know, it's a really interesting story around Hubert Joly, who's the CEO of Best Buy. And I got to hear him speak about this. And so the way he works is he completely flips that in his meetings. He has their team, they talk about their people and what's going on with the people and how can we support their people? And they spend time there. He said, oh, don't worry, the finance people, we'll get to the numbers. We won't forget about that. They won't disappear. And so for me, it starts with connection. And then what you were saying too about how do we empower people? So the idea of being a facilitative leader is about making things easier for people. And remember, you're dealing with adults, and adults like to be self-directed. Adults have egos. Adults get defensive. Adults, frankly, don't like to be told what to do. They like to be led by thinking they're leading themselves. And so is a little bit of jujitsu going on here, a little back and forth. And what you really want to do is lead. Yes, you have a clear vision of where you want to go. But instead of saying, this is where we're going, you ask people, well, where do you want to go? And then you find ways to align their vision with the vision that you already have. And you work as much as possible to make them feel that they are making the decision. So going back to empowerment, you know, there's this wonderful quote that comes from Lao Tzu, which is like over 2000 years old, who said, you know, the worst leaders people despise, the good leaders people revere, but the best leaders are the ones where the people say, we did it ourselves, right? So when leadership is that good, it feels and looks invisible. And that is a really hard place to get to, but that's what we're striving for. So it starts with connection. It moves to communication, leading by listening, seeking to understand their points of view. And now that we have common and shared understanding, then we can move together and co-create and collaborate so that we can create the positive outcome and create the vision for the future and turning that vision into reality.
And all of that requires time and effort.
All that requires
enormous time and effort. I mean, what you said is sometimes you got to go slow, sometimes you got to go fast. And you're right, we're dealing with human beings, and every single human being arrives at their place of work every single day with their own hopes, wants, desires, aspirations, you know, fears, whatever. And we as leaders need to sit there and say, it's not an automaton walking in the door. It's the person that is sitting there going, okay, you know, what are the challenges this person feels? I think it was from Simon Sinek's TED Talk, where he talks about the manager versus the leader. Mm-hmm. And he says the manager sits there and says, okay, this person's been late for 5 days. And he goes up to them and says, if you're late one more day, you're fired. And the leader goes up to them and says, you've been late for 5 days. Is everything okay? Now, exactly. I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah.
But it's a mindset shift. And the problem is, and we're going to go back to where what you said about the fact that, you know, we're sometimes thrust into leadership.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the Peter principle. You know, I love the Peter principle is that we are promoted to our level of incompetence. Mm-hmm. You know, and we're not given the skills we need to take ourselves to that next level. We might have been great tacticians, but we're not really good at showing other people how to achieve their goals. So where do we go from there? Where do we, knowing that this is reality, knowing that there is a bunch of people that come from command and control, there's a lot of people that are ill-prepared to be able to mentor, to coach, to inspire, to communicate, to empathize, whatever, you know, now that we're in the fourth industrial age, the post-industrial age, where, you know, it truly is a point in time where people are working from home, people are going to work remotely, you know, there is a far more diverse workforce. How do we help leaders be the people that their teams need so that everybody survives and thrives?
Yeah. Wow. That's the million-dollar question right there, Ben. I love it. You know, to start off with, you know, considering what you said, I want to go back to the first thing you said here, which was doing all what we're talking about, it takes work. Yes, that is the work of leadership. And it's a completely different skill set than what you're used to, which is why you probably don't want to do it because you're not so good at it. You were really good at being the executor. You were a good doer who got stuff done. And now you're saying this doesn't apply? No, it doesn't apply. Now you have to do other stuff. And this is the work. And I, you know, and it's so interesting because you have to really be interested in people. And I would go so far as to say, you have to love people to lead them well. You really need to be so interested in them that you care and you see what's going on. Because, you know, and I say this a lot too, is that lousy leadership is lazy leadership. You know, it's so much easier to be that manager sitting at the desk telling me the story like, oh, 5 days late, I guess I'm going to fire you, as opposed to 5 days late. What's going on? Let me find out. Be curious. And so what is it going to take? It is going to take, you know, as we go in this fourth industrial age and the work from home and all that, it starts with connection, communication, and collaboration. So for example, one of the things that a lot of leaders are struggling with, they say, Alain, tell me, like, it was hard to lead in the office. And now I'm having to do this where I can't even see people. What do I do? Well, first I say, make time to spend with each person one-on-one. They said, how much time? I said, I don't know, but more than you think probably to start with. And then when you get on the Zoom or whatever it is you're on with them, whatever platform you're on, ask them these three questions. And I call it the check-in questions. And I've written articles about this too. We can put them in the links in the show notes, whatever. But they're really simple. Three questions. Number one, how are you feeling? And not like, I'm fine, how are you? But like, really, how are you feeling? See, the silver lining in this COVID crisis is that now you can actually say something other than I'm fine, how are you? Because the world has broken open. We were all facing life and death, sickness and wellness in a way that this has touched everyone on some level. So what's going on? Like, how are you? Like, and so to listen and really listen, right? It's just, and when people are sharing, there's no need to fix. There's no need to judge, to give advice. It's just, how are you feeling? And just creating some space for people. Now, some people hear that and they go, oh my gosh, what are you asking me to be a group therapist? I'm not a therapist. I'm a leader at a whatever sausage making company. We're not asking you to be a therapist. What we're asking you to be is an empathic human being. Okay. Prerequisite of being a good leader is being a good human. And a good human can ask somebody how they're feeling and listen to them without interrupting them. Right. So get on my soapbox on this one a little bit. So that's number one. Number two, what's distracting you? What's on your mind? Because there's a lot of things that can keep people from being focused. And what we know is that in this fourth industrial age, some people call this the attention economy. We need our people to be able to attend to what they're doing. And if they can't attend, they can't perform at their best. So whatever it is that's distracting them, to give them the safe space, or some people might know the psychologically safe space, to be able to express that with any fear of repercussion, right? So just what's going on? So how are you feeling? What's distracting you? And then question number three, how can I support you? What can I do to be of service? And they'll tell you, right? So again, the great thing about being this facilitative leader is you don't need to have the answers. What you need to have are really good questions, ask them, and then shut up and listen to the answers. And then you have to act on the information that's being shared and then check in with them. Is this working for you? And then what else can we do? And it might be different tomorrow. All of that, I spent more time explaining it than it would take to actually do it, right? Think about it. That's a 3-minute conversation. And people think, but we have a job to do. It's like, again, if you say we have a job to do, you are operating from an industrial age efficiency mindset. And part of moving into becoming the facilitative leader is you have to start to learn to value effectiveness over efficiency, right? So the efficiency mindset was what got the factory floors. Like, we can't stop the assembly line. Unless you are making widgets, and like you said before, your widgets are being made by robots today anyway. You are not in the widget making business. You are in the human being business. And so taking that time up front to value effectiveness, then you can get into the efficiency. Again, knowing when to go slow and knowing when to go fast. So I would start there, because your people care. And people, and I've had leaders say to me, well, I don't have time to do this with all my people because I've got my own stuff to do. I said, if you don't have time, I don't think it's a time issue. I think it's a priority issue. If this was really important to you, because you realize that when we lead this way, the time that we spend, that 5-minute or 10-minute, whatever it is, check-in time, that is a massive multiplier. Because you've had this experience, Ben, we've all had this experience, that a good 5 or 10 minutes or a half an hour with a leader can set you on the course for a super productive week, or even I'll say month, right? This is the power of great leadership. And also the flip side is, how many of us have the one-on-one and our leader's like, oh, I'm going to have to reschedule. We have this customer meeting or this thing, and I don't have time for you. Can we push it off? And then they push it off another month and another month, and your engagement starts to wane. And before you know it, you're spending your days looking at Glassdoor and LinkedIn for another job because you're just really bored out of your mind and you think this place sucks. So it starts by being human and starting with that check-in, those three questions. How are you feeling? What's on your mind? How can I support you? And then from there, building out to some shared communication and then moving on to collaboration. So the principles don't change. The venue in which we're playing is changed, but the principles don't change.
I agree. I mean, I tell people all the time that your brand is only as valuable as your unhappiest employee on their worst day. And how do you make employees, unhappy? They feel unengaged, they feel unempowered, and they don't feel listened to. But you talked about something, and this is something that we can wrap up with, and I think it's really important, about the leader being all-knowing. There is this perception out there by leaders that they have to know everything, and they can't show weakness. They can't show that they don't know everything. And I think, personally, that's a horrible place to come from. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
You're absolutely right. It is a horrible place to come from. And you know what that really is about? That is not about anything other than your ego. It is really about your ego and the need to seem important. It's like, who would I be if I wasn't this important, if I didn't throw my ego around this room? It's crazy. So there's a fabulous story. Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft. So Satya Nadella took over. So I know we're recording this today. Today it happens to be February the 5th, 2011. Satya Nadella took over at Microsoft exactly 7 years ago yesterday, February the 4th, in 2014. He took over. He had been a 20-year employee at Microsoft. Now, before he was the CEO, Steve Ballmer was CEO number two after Bill Gates. And for those that know Microsoft history, Bill Gates kind of put it into the stratosphere because suddenly everyone in the world had Windows. It was a massive company, huge success, multi-billion-dollar company. Steve Ballmer took it over for 7 years, and their earnings were flat for years, 7 years under Ballmer. So Nadella comes in. Now, Ballmer, some people might know him because he's also the owner of the Los Angeles Clippers, if you watch the National Basketball Association. He is a rah-rah sales guy, like, in your face, this is it. And the culture at Microsoft at the time was everyone had to be the smartest guy in the room. And I say guy because that was the very macho male software IT culture. And that was the way it was under Ballmer. Satya Nadella is not that way at all. In fact, his first executive team meeting, he brought every single person on the executive team a copy of a book called Nonviolent Communication, which is not so much a book as it's a manifesto of a way of thinking in the world. And he also started bringing in the ideas, and you might be familiar with Carol Dweck's work, Mindset, about the importance of having a growth mindset, which is about being open to experience and learning. And the way Nadella described it is that he came in and inherited a culture of know-it-alls. And what he had to do was turn around and create a culture of learn-it-alls, people that would shut up and listen and not think they had to have all the answers and actually listen to each other and listen to their employees and listen to their customers. And if you look about what Microsoft was doing just in the marketplace in terms of their products and their services, I mean, they were full out with their Windows software. Look at how they've shifted of what they're doing today versus there. So the culture has completely shifted to go away from this gotta know, gotta be the leader with all the answers. And in fact, they have this massive company-wide coaching program where they're teaching leaders at all levels a coach-like approach, how to ask good questions, how to hold space for people, how to inquire, how to dig deeper. Well, for those that are listening going, oh, that sounds so soft and fuzzy, let's go bring it back because the proof is in the pudding. So when Satya Nadella took over 7 years ago yesterday, the market cap of Microsoft was $301 billion. I checked it on Monday of this week. The market cap for Microsoft has just crossed over $1.8 trillion.
So it's six times.
Six times more valuable than it was when he took over 7 years ago. So
almost a multiple a year.
Yeah, almost a multiple per year. So to me, it's just, I mean, and you don't have to be Satya Nadella to start doing this, right? It's like going, okay, where can I drop my know-it-all mindset? How can I take off, I call it my superhero cape, you know, where they think what would this place be without me? You know, life will go on without you being in that role. You might not think so, but it's a really useful lesson to learn, to go through.
Yeah, it's funny because I had a conversation the other day with a company that says the best founders need to get out of the CEO chair. They truly need to get out of the CEO chair. They can be the visionaries. They can be the people that have the purpose, the vision, the culture people, do all that kind of stuff and hire great leadership to be able to install all that inside their organization. Because it's a completely different skill set. Yeah. It's an absolutely completely different skill set because if you have this visionary leader that says, follow me, but I don't really know how we're going to, how we're going to make this happen. It doesn't really happen, but you need to have both. And I think that there's, that's where leadership needs to be. Leadership needs to understand this is what I do well. This is what I don't do well. And I need to bring in people that are smarter than me in a variety of different areas that I can lean on and gather their advice when I'm in a position where I'm going, I just don't know, and be okay with that.
And what you just described, Ben, that is the facilitative mindset in action, right? If you think about if you're in a room of people and you're the facilitative leader and someone says, hey, Ben, what do you think we should do about this? Like, I don't know. And then you say, that's a really good question. What do other people think? And so harnessing the wisdom of the room, I don't have to suddenly come up with stuff, or I can say, that's really good. I'm going to come back to you on that. I want to really think about that. That's okay. And frankly, people respect that. People respect that so much more because let's face it, we all know when leaders are blowing smoke at us. We all know when they're bluffing and just putting on the bravado show. And we're tired of it because we see how ineffective it is.
Yeah, it truly is. This has been an amazing conversation. It could go for a couple hours. I mean, I would love for this to go for a couple hours, and it probably will offline. But what I want to talk to you about, and this is the last question I ask for people, and we'll make sure that all your information is in the show notes. I'll get links to those articles so we can make sure that we have it, and links to your book, etc. But this is the question I ask people. When you leave a meeting or you get off the stage and you get in your car and you drive away, what's the one thing you want people to think about you when you're not in the room?
Great question. So for me, it brings me back to the famous quote from Maya Angelou, which people won't remember what you said, they won't remember what you did, but they'll remember how you made them feel. And for me, what I want people to feel is, I mean, the shorthand word is real, is that they had a real, like, you're the, like the highest praise for me around my work and who I am is, Elena, you're the real deal. Because I feel like, you know, here I'm talking about leadership. I mean, it's really easy to talk about it and not to live it. And I'm not saying I'm perfect, but I really strive to live these principles in my life, because I feel like without doing that and being on that journey, I wouldn't listen to me. So for me, it's just that sort of, you know, at the end of the day, I'm still a kid from Queens, right? And I've got to make it real and accessible. And so I want people thinking that this is real and he's the real deal.
Well, keep being authentically you. I love that. And, you know, keep doing the things that shine a light on leadership, and keep doing the things that elevate the conversation, because we need it. And so thank you for being an amazing guest.
Ben, thank you. This has been an awesome, awesome conversation.
This has been the YourLivingBrand.live show. I want to thank you for tuning in today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show at YourLivingBrand.live and share your favorite episodes with colleagues and friends. At Your Brand Marketing, we help companies engage, retain, and grow their most valuable assets, their employees. If you're tired of losing great staff and want to retain your best employees, build brand champions and leaders at any level. Contact us for a 30-minute consultation at yourbrandmarketing.com. That's www.yourbrandmarketing.com. Thank you again for listening and sharing. Tune in next week when we ask another guest, what's your story?